Random House Audio presents Suite Française by Irène Nemirovsky. Read for you by Daniel Oreskes and Barbara Rosenblatt.
Storm in June. Read for you by Dan Oreskes.
Chapter 1. War. Hot, thought the Parisians. The warm air of spring. It was night. They were at war and there was an air raid. But dawn was near and the war far away. The first to hear the hum of the siren were those who couldn't sleep. The ill and bedridden, mothers with sons at the front, women crying for the men they loved. To them it began as a long breath, like air being forced into a deep sigh. But soon its wailing filled the sky. It came from afar, from beyond the horizon, slowly, almost lazily. Those still asleep dreamed of waves breaking over pebbles, a March storm whipping the woods, a herd of cows trampling the ground with their hooves, until finally sleep was shaken off and they struggled to open their eyes, murmuring, "Is it an air raid?" The women, more anxious, more alert, were already up, although some of them, after closing the windows and shutters, went back to bed. The night before, Monday, 3 June, bombs had fallen on Paris for the first time since the beginning of the war, yet everyone remained calm. Even though the reports were terrible, no one believed them, no more so than if victory had been announced. "We don't understand what's happening," people said. They had to dress their children by torchlight. Mothers lifted small, warm, heavy bodies into their arms. "Come on, don't be afraid. Don't cry." An air raid. All the lights were out, but beneath the clear, golden June sky, every house, every street was visible. As for the Seine, the river seemed to absorb even the faintest glimmers of light and reflect them back 100 times brighter, like some multifaceted mirror. Badly blacked out windows, glistening rooftops, the metal hinges of doors all shone in the water. There were a few red lights that stayed on longer than the others, no one knew why, and the Seine drew them in, capturing them and bouncing them playfully on its waves. From above it could be seen flowing along, as white as a river of milk. It guided the enemy planes, some people thought. Others said that couldn't be so. In truth, no one really knew anything. "I'm staying in bed," sleepy voices murmured. "I'm not scared. All the same, it just takes one," the more sensible replied. Through the windows that ran along the service stairs in new apartment blocks, little flashes of light could be seen descending. The people living on the 6th floor were fleeing the upper stories. They held their torches in front of them, in spite of the regulations.
"Do you think I want to fall on my face on the stairs? Are you coming, Emile?"
Everyone instinctively lowered their voices, as if the enemy's eyes and ears were everywhere. One after another, doors slammed shut. In the poorer neighborhoods, there was always a crowd in the metro or the foul-smelling shelters. The wealthy simply went to sit with the concierge, straining to hear the shells bursting and the explosions that meant bombs were falling, their bodies as tense as frightened animals in dark woods, as the hunter gets closer. Though the poor were just as afraid as the rich, and valued their lives just as much, they were more sheep-like. They needed each other, needed to link arms, to groan or laugh together. Day was breaking. A silvery blue light slid over the cobblestones, over the parapets along the quayside, over the towers of Notre Dame. Bags of sand were piled halfway up all the important monuments, encircling Carpo's dancers on the facade of the Opera House, silencing the Marseillaise on the Arc de Triomphe. Still at some distance, great guns were firing. They drew nearer, and every window shuddered in reply. In hot rooms with blacked-out windows, children were born, and their cries made the women forget the sound of sirens and war. To the dying, the barrage of gunfire seemed far away, without any meaning whatsoever. Just one more element in that vague, menacing whisper that washes over those on the brink of death. Children slept peacefully, held tight against their mother's sides, their lips making sucking noises like little lambs. Street sellers' carts lay abandoned, full of fresh flowers. The sun came up, fiery red in a cloudless sky. A shell was fired, now so close to Paris that from the top of every monument, birds rose into the sky. Great blackbirds, rarely seen at other times, stretched out their pink-tinged wings. Beautiful fat pigeons cooed, swallows wheeled, sparrows hopped peacefully in the deserted streets. Along the Seine, each poplar tree held a cluster of little brown birds who sang as loudly as they could. From deep beneath the ground came the muffled noise everyone had been waiting for, a sort of three-tone fanfare. The air raid was over. Chapter 2. In the Perricon household, they listened in shocked silence to the evening news on the radio, but no one passed comment on the latest developments. The Perricons were a cultivated family. Their traditions, their way of thinking, their middle class, Catholic background, their ties with the church. Their eldest son, Philippe Perricon, was a priest. All these things made them mistrustful of the government of France. On the other hand, Monsieur Perricon's position as curator of one of the country's national museums bound them to an administration that showered its faithful with honors and financial rewards. A cat held a little piece of bony fish tentatively between its sharp teeth. He was afraid to swallow it, but he couldn't bring himself to spit it out either. Madame Perricon finally decided that only a male mind could explain with clarity such strange, serious events. Neither her husband nor her eldest son was at home. Her husband was dining with friends. Her son was not in Paris. Charlotte Perricon, who ruled the family's daily life with an iron hand, whether it was managing the household, her children's education, or her husband's career, was not in the habit of seeking anyone's opinion. But this was of a different order. She needed a voice of authority to tell her what to believe. Once pointed in the right direction, there would be no stopping her. Even if given absolute proof she was mistaken, she would reply with a cold, condescending smile, "My father said so. My husband is very well informed." And she would make a dismissive little gesture with her gloved hand. She took pride in her husband's position. She herself would have preferred a more domestic lifestyle, but following the example of our dear Savior, each of us has his cross to bear. She had come home between appointments to oversee her children's studies, the baby's bottles and the servant's work, but she didn't have time to take off her hat and coat. For as long as the Perricon children could remember, their mother was always ready to go out armed with hat and white gloves. Since she was thrifty, her gloves had the faint smell of stain remover, a reminder of their passage through the dry cleaners. As soon as she had come in this evening, she had gone to stand in front of the radio in the drawing room. Her clothes were black, her hat a divine little creation in fashion that season, decorated with three flowers and topped with a silk pom-pom. Beneath it, her face was pale and anguished, emphasizing the marks of age and fatigue. She was 47 years old and had 5 children. You would have thought, to look at her, that God had intended her to be a redhead. Her skin was extremely delicate, lined by the passing years. Freckles were dotted over her strong, majestic nose. The expression in her green eyes was as sharp as a cat's. At the last minute, however, it seemed that Providence had wavered, or decided that a shock of red hair would not be appropriate, neither to Madame Perricon's irreproachable morals, nor to her social status. So she had been given mousy brown hair, which she was losing by the handful since she'd had her last child. Monsieur Perricon was a man of great discipline. His religious scruples prohibited a number of pleasures, and his concern for his reputation kept him away from places of ill repute. The youngest Perricon child was only 2, and between Father Philippe and the baby, there were 3 other children, not counting the ones Madame Perricon discreetly referred to as the 3 accidents. Babies she had carried almost a term before losing them. So that 3 times their mother had been on the verge of death. The drawing room where the radio was now playing was enormous and well-proportioned, with 4 windows overlooking the Boulevard de la Serre. It was furnished in traditional style, with large armchairs and settees upholstered in gold and yellow. Next to the balcony, the elder Monsieur Perricon sat in his wheelchair. He was an invalid whose advance.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?